a little bit of a script here. So I will read it to you. So, hello, my friends. Bonjour, mes amis. Welcome to Nova Scotia. Bienvenue à Nouvelle-Écosse. The original name of Nova Scotia is from the Mi'kmaq word, and I can't pronounce it, but it sounds like Chibouctouc. The nom d'original était Chibouctouc. Let us respect the unceded territory of the Mi'kmaq nation upon which we are standing and upon which we are sitting today. Laissez-nous vivre sur le chemin du respect des Mi'kmaq territoires. So, here we are. Here we are. And when I started this association, or thought about this association, it was in this vicinity. I was a professor across the street in the School of Nursing, and from there the ideas originated. And now here we are at the 30th anniversary of the first conference, on the very day that we had our first conference in PEI. Isn't that amazing? So I'm going to read this, or else I'll keep talking and rambling on and on. To give an account of the history of CON, it is important to place it within a particular context, not only of an era, but place of origin, and the background of the co-founders, myself as the originator of the idea in Halifax in 1986, and Margaret Alamang, co-founder with me in Toronto. I had graduate degrees in sociology and Margaret in education. Both of us were professors in university schools of nursing. I'll put it right there, thank you. But I was the younger, and Margaret was 25 years older and retired. And here I am now standing in Margaret's shoes. Age, experience, workplace privileges, and where we were living determined how we went about developing such an organization, given this vast Canadian country. Both Margaret and I had experience in producing oral histories. Margaret's work was with the nursing sisters in both world wars. She had completed her doctoral degree in education, exploring the history of nursing education in Canada and the US. Although we were not trained historians, but came from sociology and education, we were qualified as social historians and educational historians. While we approached our research from different angles, we blended rather than opposed one another. I had the advantage of the university's resources, and although Margaret was professor emerita, she didn't have as many privileges as I did in that regard. Nonetheless, she had more advantages than I did, just by the mere fact alone that she lived in Ontario, while I was living and working in the second smallest province in Canada, often considered remote from Upper Canada and certainly from the West. How we came together was by happenstance. While I was in the library across the street, mulling over what I would do with the 35 oral histories of nurses in Nova Scotia who had worked in the 1920s and 30s. I did these in the early 80s when I was writing my doctoral dissertation. The best way to get out of doing something that you don't want to do is to take on another project. So what I decided to do was to go across the province and do some oral histories of nurses. And I stored those down the road, they're still there, in the Nova Scotia archives. And some of former students have digitized some of them for me, but you can all have access to these wonderful women's voices, none of whom are living any longer, of course. I read of Margaret's oral histories and knew that I had a kindred spirit. The idea began to grow. What if we had a forum for presenting our findings and others could present their ideas about those olden days? What I actually hoped for was a home for gender analysis of the nursing profession. What if we had a society or an organization and met somewhat regularly to talk about the evolution of the profession? What would it look like? I found literature about the History Society of the Royal College of Nursing and others about two American History of Nursing Associations, but I veered toward the UK experience. In the meantime, I purchased a most elegant secondhand typewriter, and the faculty could hear me tapping away in my office. They were very jealous. It was an exciting time for me. The director of the school said I could post letters without fee. I could also make some long-distance phone calls through the school. So it began. I wrote to Dr. Monica Bailey at the Royal College in London to say that my husband and I were going to England in June and could we meet? She responded quickly and a date was set up. I then called Margaret and introduced myself, asking if we could meet in Toronto on our way to England. She agreed and we set up a plan to meet in a coffee shop. The rest is history. We agreed it was time to begin such an organization, but we had many things to do before we could develop concrete plans. Margaret would speak with friends in Toronto to gauge if there was interest. I would see what advice the Royal College could give me. For some reason, the dates for meeting with Monica became mixed up, and she wasn't there. Yet it turned out well, as I had the grand tour of the Royal College, and a call from them to Monica resulted in our visit to her home in the Royal Crescent in Bath, which was in and of itself phenomenal. She spoke at great length about their society and then she said, just go home and do it. Good advice, but did she really know how big our country was? How, I wondered, how was I going to do this? Back home I was supercharged and letters, mine typed, Margaret's handwritten, flowed back and forth. Often I called her, but I saved the letters. I had thought initially, Monday, I better not just talk off the cuff. I better write this down, because this is a book with all of our letters that I've saved. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll do a PowerPoint. And the reason I didn't was because Margaret was the worst handwriter I had ever seen. And as I was rereading a lot of these letters, I still can't make out what she was saying. So I thought, PowerPoint is just not going to work for this presentation. I loved her dearly, but she should have been a medical doctor with handwriting like that. In August 1986, I typed a letter and a small survey with the letter, and I posted them with asking for information. We waited in great anticipation, but I couldn't find any people in Nova Scotia with whom I could generate much interest, but Margaret knew lots of people in Ontario, so I had lots of names. How were we going to mobilize such a group? We were invited to attend a board meeting with the American Association for the History of Nursing Incorporated, in order to find out how they had organized themselves, and Margaret attended, but we decided early on we would not affiliate with them. She graciously told them so. Nonetheless, we had now checked out the American and the British groups and determined that context was important, and we were indeed interested in Canadian nursing history, or at least those who are Canadian nurses doing or interested in nursing history. It is important to note here that we unconsciously were focusing primarily on those who actually did nursing history, rather than an interest group or a society per se. January 12th, 1987, I sent a letter to all who had responded, almost 100 people. Can you imagine what the postage would be like today? Remember now, this is in the 1980s. We didn't have the internet. And to CNA and provincial buildings after Margaret and I agreed on a date, June 8th, 1987, 9 a.m., room 201, the Jean Gunn Room at the University of Toronto. Worried that we would be seen to be only academics, I wrote about that in the letter. We set a tentative agenda. I came to Toronto and stayed with Margaret, and I remember that we seemed to stay up half the night wondering what the next day would bring. After all, the people attending from out of province would be paying for this trip themselves. So we had to do a great deal in just one day. We knew that the Ontario group would suggest Margaret for president, but she wanted me to be. So she would refuse, but would accept being the vice president. Our first meeting, all of this is recorded, by the way, in this book. Our first meeting, there were 28 nurses, 20 from Ontario, one from Alberta, one from Quebec, two from Saskatchewan, one from New Brunswick, two from British Columbia, and me from Nova Scotia. Our names are preserved in this booklet. Pictures are shown in your booklets, the program, and there's a poster available for those of you who might know of some of them. Natalie Rigler volunteered to become the secretary in the morning and Judy Young in the afternoon. Is Judy here? Mm-hmm. Oh, hi, Judy. and did you? Were you a good secretary in the afternoon, Judy? Mm-hmm. Were you a good secretary in that afternoon?
I guess.
Okay. So here we were now. Natalie, then the questions, would we become a society, a CNA interest group? If so, only members who were RNs would be eligible. And we decided on, would it be an organization or an association? We decided at least on the name, and Gertrude Jacobs provided the French version, and the questions were enormous, and we were in somewhat of a hurry. We were overly ambitious. The aims and objectives, when I reread this, amazing. We were going to preserve artifacts, we were going to collect it, we were going to do all sorts of things which are just absolutely impossible. The meeting was extremely productive. Would we become an association? And there were more questions than answers at that meeting. But Myrtle Crawford from the University of Saskatchewan brought the results and the queries back to her province and established a working group. A committee of four in Saskatoon wrote an extensive proposed constitution and bylaws. It was written that the association should be open to all nurses and persons other than nurses with an interest in the history of nursing. It was Myrtle who worked diligently for us to become a charitable organization. She was the chair of this formidable committee, which developed the plan of action, and we made a decision that we would discuss these proposals at our first conference the next year. By the time the first conference was held in PEI following the CNA conference on June 15, we had this document of Myrtle's to discuss in detail. Happily, one of my fourth-year students, a nurse who had an art degree, Eric Robertson, designed our logo, which we still use today. Even then, I was obsessed with copyright, so we bought it from him, the copyright, for $1. We didn't have any money. And he was anxious to get a good mark in my class. It was Margaret who was the chair of the planning committee, along with Irene Goldstone, Gertrude Jacobs, and Diana Mansell. None of the women lived in PEI, and they organized the first conference. Can you imagine what that was like? Not living near where the conference was to be held was an enormous task, but it was very successful. Margaret had contacted the Hanna Institute of Medicine, and they willingly agreed to pay the cost for our guest speaker, who was to be none other than my friend, Dr. Monica Bailey. Abstracts were sent out, and there were 14 papers accepted and 7 poster presentations. It was our first conference, 30 years ago to this day, and it was a grand event. After the conference, we accomplished more important business, and we were on a roll. Now this is me remembering, and remember, I just wrote this a couple days ago, but it's interesting, the lovely things that happen to you in old age. You can remember so much from the past, you just can't remember very much about what you've done yesterday. Where did our energy come from, trying to organize an association in this vast country of ours without all the modern day internet conveniences, finding addresses, writing letters, trying to read Margaret's handwriting, wondering how to meet the different needs of individuals, welcoming suggestions that were often at odds with one another, I can tell you that. Building momentum. It was Margaret with her contacts, experiences, calm and generous personality that kept me afloat. I worried a great deal about the Ontario contingent, knowing that the rest of the small membership often resented how large their group was compared to the rest of the country, and which might not be well regarded. They could and did meet regularly. I had no one in Nova Scotia. And Anne-Marie, where are you? I was talking to you. Oh, there you are right there by Judy. You know what it was like in New Brunswick. You had two people that were interested, you and Arlie McGee. So what were we going to do now? I'm now at the age that Margaret and Monica were then, retired and Professor Emerita as they were. I could not do now what they did even then, though life is much simpler in terms of communication now with the internet. The second conference in Toronto generated an unrest in me, and this was became a serious problem for me personally. An older male history professor, not a nurse, gave his closing remarks with what I consider undue criticism. His view was that most of the papers were not pure history, nor were the majority of the presenters trained historians. At that point, most of the membership were nurses and indeed not trained as historians. Later, more history students and bona fide historians joined the association. But as a fledgling organization, we were still mainly nurses. Many of us were doing social history, which did not seem to be something he was fond of. However, as a sociologist, I had heard this argument from many historians. There were many criticisms from traditional historians in days gone by, especially as the sociology profession emerged and they had such greats as Durkheim and Weber and Comte and Karl Marx, whose works can be legitimately considered history. The same can be applied to anthropologists, for example. It seemed to me that though many were impinging on the history profession as amateurs or those doing genealogy, journalists, educators, now in these later years, looking back, I might have had the courage to challenge this view. I believe it is now, for me, a moot point, yet one I grappled with for a number of years as the president for the first two years. But for me, the challenge now, which I didn't think of then, is how the association can entice members who are not academics and thereby generating interest of others who are not interested in building academic careers. From the words of one responder who wrote to me November the 11th, 1986, Isabel McRae, she said that we should be an interest group. I would also hope that this interest group could remain just that and not turn into a power base for some hungry academics. Maybe that is what history of nursing associations have become. Perhaps we should remain an association for those who want to present their research to an audience of other academics. Otherwise, we could be known as a society with different aims. But knowing that the general public of nurses would not pay the cost of coming to a conference of our nature, it seems likely we will remain somewhat on the fringe to the larger nursing community. Most young nurses trying to obtain a position in academia cannot lay claim to their graduate work as being in the history of nursing realm, as fewer and fewer jobs are available for those without a more clinical focus. The field, however, is open to academic historians who are interested in women and work and other issues related to the political economy of healthcare and so on. Now our association has evolved as a public forum for both nurses and historians. It is not just listening to the voices of nurses from the past as in oral histories, but writing about social issues and political issues and broadening the focus of the association, or perhaps in some cases, just recording what was. It was a dilemma about being exclusive to nurses, primarily academics, that I had not considered in 1986, and one which I believe was a conundrum. We had to let go of the idea that only nurses should write nursing history. But in the early 1970s, I guess, around the 1970s, when I was reading work from the famous theorists Glaser and Strauss, who were doing research on nurses, and it was among the first pieces of data that I had read, I was initially hostile. How can these two men, who are sociologists but they're not nurses, how can they possibly write about nursing history if they haven't been a nurse? So I had those kinds of issues that were mulling around with me. Nonetheless, it is often we oldsters who are the most interested in our lived experience of the past, in storytelling and reminiscing with others with whom we can relate. We like to read about stories of great heroines or heroes or rank and file nurses in their own right who are people that we can admire and respect. Now this leads me to some great stories you can read about over in the table upstairs who have made a quiet impact on Nova Scotia history. So ends my brief history of the association, and I want to talk a little bit more about this book. I got all these little stickies that I'm not going to read because it takes too long, but in my research methods class in 1988, I preserved all of these letters and all the, you can see, some of you might be able to see some of Margaret's handwriting. Luckily, I had a typewriter, so mine are all discernible. Anyway, I had three students who were RNs and were studying for their post-baccalaureate degree, and I asked them in my research methodology class if they would take, hi Peter, if they would take, we should have this history debate someday. Maybe we already have. I took all of these papers and put them together for these students and said, this can be part of what you are going to be graded on if you would be willing to put them in some sort of a booklet. So all the originals were put together and they actually had them bound. They gave me a copy and I gave the president at that time the original. I have no idea what happened to them. They were gone. They're gone. Somebody has them in their attic. I don't know. If anybody here has them in their attic, please let me know. At any rate, a couple of years ago, I was interviewed. I already forgot who did that. And I told her that I had such a book, and she couldn't find it, but she took this and made a copy, and now there is one somewhere. I don't know if it floats around with the president from year to year, but it's very hard to, I can't say that these are original documents, but they're photocopied documents of the history of the association. So I think it's a really interesting thing that we've got this, so I'm really thankful to those students for having done that. And they have a little bit of analysis too at the beginning. So I want to talk a little bit about the book because I think it's important that you understand that we are trying to raise funds. We're trying to raise funds for two things. One is that we have wonderful cards up there. My husband's upstairs manning, not womaning, but he's manning the table. And he's selling these cards that mostly Alan Tabaka took the photos of, although there's some of Gloria's. And on the back of the cards, we describe the history of nursing in Nova Scotia. So if you're going to buy a postcard from here, forget it. Buy one of those cards and send instead. And the book is one that the proceeds of which are going to be going to build the base of a statue of a great humanitarian nurse. A couple of years ago, I was reminiscing about my student nursing days in Yarmouth School of Nursing. For those of you who are not from Nova Scotia, the book has some history of each little school of nursing that I mentioned, and Yarmouth happens to be at the southwestern tip of Nova Scotia. It was a three-year diploma program, and when I wrote a small, unedited recounting of those difficult times, I gave it to a few friends, but suddenly, no doubt because of my age, I wanted to reach out to others who had experienced the same kinds of exploitation of students in small-town hospitals in Nova Scotia during the same era. It was then that I found a woman from our History of Nursing group and got together, and I decided I'm going to be doing some more oral histories. When I graduated in 1959, I realized that student nurses' experiences began to change somewhat in the 60s, not a lot. But during the 1950s, student nurses' lives remained the same as past decades. We were still used as a source of free labor. The ways in which we were overworked, not paid, often without days off, and certainly not protected by a union, as nurses did not have unions that exemplified our 3 years. Just a little bit more and then I'll be through. It's a wonder that Gloria isn't signaling me. I know that. It began to dawn on me that no one seemed to be doing much to preserve the stories of the 1950s, since I had done all these oral histories of Nova Scotia nurses in the 20s, 30s, and some in the 40s, other than that little booklet that I had written. So these are all stories that make up an integral part of Nova Scotia history, but even more importantly, they're the history of nursing throughout Canada, certainly, and many in the US would say the same, which is mainly about women, and even more significantly, that they are the voices of older women who have always been silent, and the ways in which they were exploited and overworked. Included in this book are local histories of small towns in Nova Scotia. I know that many experiences were the same as those of student nurses everywhere in the US and Canada because of the lack of job opportunities for graduate nurses. So writing about the history of nursing students was not just a local endeavor. In fact, it reflected a great deal about the province and the country as a whole. In the book, there are 12 schools of nursing outside of Halifax. And in the 1950s. So I slowly tracked down one by one an older woman who had trained in each of these small hospitals, and also one from the 1940s and one from the 1960s, in order to track changes, if any. And because I'm retired and because I don't have to go a little bit crazy about APA referencing anymore, I wrote it in journalistic style with a few references. I think it's an interesting read, but then that's my own biased opinion. So the towns that are represented are written about in the book. It was then that I knew I could not accept payment for a book, which had become our stories, but that I had to give something back to the profession that had provided me with the privileges of a career which I had come to love. At the same time, I discovered Sarah Corning. She became my passion. So this is where the proceeds will go. To honor this humanitarian Canadian Nova Scotian nurse heroine under the auspices of our Nova Scotia Nursing History Society. In this era of taking down statues of unsavory men, we need to produce statues of phenomenal women. In 1919, Sarah was sent from the Red Cross, where she helped to rescue and care for thousands of orphans, victims of the 1915-1923 Armenian genocide and Greek massacres. King George II of Greece honored her for her bravery and courage. Here in Canada, in 2017, she was honored as an outstanding Canadian past recipients include Prime Minister Chrétien, Margaret Atwood, Canada's first astronaut, Dr. Roberta Bondar, and Canadian-Armenian filmmaker Anton Egoyan, is that how you say it? Sarah's headstone reads, "She lived to serve others." We at the History of Nursing Society will make a donation through the proceeds of this book for the base of the statue now being made in Armenia and next year to be erected in Yarmouth, Nova Scotia. She died at the ripe old age back in her hometown of Yarmouth at 97. The aim of the Nova Scotia Corning Society is to erect this statue, establish scholarships for student nurses, a peace park, and already a street that has been named after her in her hometown. Equally, if not even more significant, is the Sarah Corning Center for Genocide Education in Toronto. Please Google her. And please attend the presentation because you'll have even more information about the Armenian massacre. I don't know what day you are presenting. I haven't. It's Sunday morning. Sunday morning, from Harag. Dobian, is that good enough? At this conference, and he'll talk about the Holocaust, the Armenian Holocaust, genocide. And I think we have to use that word, although there are some people in the Sarah Corning Society in Yarmouth who aren't happy about us using the word genocide. But it is what it is, and we have to call it like it was. The stories are interesting in the book and memorable. For those of you not familiar with Nova Scotia, I think that you will learn a little bit about these small towns. You'll hear the history of women, older women, and the 14 women have all had a copy of the book, and their response has been heart-rendering. One 92-year-old woman called me, and she said, "I just got your book today, and I'm famous. I'm famous in Cape Breton. I've never been in a book before. I'm passing this on to my children and my grandchildren. I can't believe I'm in a book." It's only $20, and the proceeds are for a wonderful cause for nursing women and to establish more and more statues throughout this world of important women. Thank you. Merci beaucoup. I'll leave this up on the desk by the books if you want to.
Barbara, just stay with me for a few minutes.
Sure.
I need to find it. Gloria, come help me. Just stay with me. Gloria, can you come for me, please? Oh. Is that it?
Okay.
Do you know what's going?
No. But I just saw what you did. I got a flash of it.
You have a flash of it?
Yeah.
Alors, on behalf of the Canadian Association of History of Nursing, the Executive Committee is really proud to give you a contribution, an award for your contribution for this association.
Oh,
thank you.
Thank you
a lot. Thank you for your speech.
Oh, thank you so much. It's lovely. And look at Eric's hourglass logo. It's still there after all these years. I don't even know. Does anybody know Eric?
No.
I don't know whatever happened to him.
Gloria. Okay. All the best, Barb. Thank you.
The original signatures I had framed, and I swear, like it was framed. I had it all my life since the 80s, and I swear I gave it to you a couple of years ago for upstairs, and you say no.
No. Okay, Barb, we have to move on. Good, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Gloria is keeping us on schedule. So this year, for the ANA lectures, we are pleased to welcome Dr. Janet Greenlees. She's a senior lecturer in Glasgow Caledonian University. She's an historian of both modern America and modern Britain. Her broad research interests cover many aspects of health history, urban history, and women's history. She published in 2016 a book called Female Labor Power, Women Workers' Influence on Business Practices in the British and American Cotton Industry in 1780s to 1860. And she has a book coming, hopefully in Christmas, Her new book will be When the Air Became Important, A Social History of the American and British Textile and Environment. She is today presenting about nurses and prenatal care for poor women in the United States and Great Britain. Welcome.
Thank you for that kind introduction and for the invitation to the beautiful city of Halifax. I arrived here in Nova Scotia a couple of days ago and I've been having a look around and it's absolutely beautiful. So thank you so much for inviting me here and to share some of my research about from my new project about the development of prenatal care since the late 19th century. Now, my topic did not arrive from television, but I must admit sometimes when I start thinking about it, the TV show, let's just move that there. Do it that way. There we go. The TV show called The Midwife pops to mind. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah.
Good. I had this panic on the plane. What if it hasn't made it to Canada? but those of you who are familiar with the TV show, you might recognize this clinic in Poplar, London from the most recent series, which was set in the 1960s. And here, triple duty nurses provided pregnancy checks either in the clinic or sometimes in a woman's home. They also delivered the babies and provided postnatal visits to check up on both the mother and the infant, and providing health education as well throughout all the visits. They also offered community nursing services. Now, the show includes examples of women who went into labor without having had any prenatal care. It does suggest that after World War II, uptake of prenatal checks in Great Britain were increasing. But this was both a gradual and a recent change, because until about World War I, infant welfare activists ignored prenatal care because there was a widespread belief among doctors and governments that preventive care was either unaffordable, unnecessary, or possibly even both. And despite high infant and maternal mortality rates, these beliefs were slow to fade in some Western countries, with some politicians, doctors, and even patients remaining skeptical about the value of prenatal checks into the mid-20th century. Indeed, even today, the World Health Organization has found that 64% of women worldwide do not receive any or adequate health checks when pregnant. Now, while these figures are better in Western countries, there still remain pockets of low-income communities where women either choose not to engage with prenatal healthcare or are not aware of the health benefits to either themselves or their infants. So today I want to have a look at sort of the development of prenatal care and some of the initiatives that worked and those that did not work, with the hopes that if we are to understand today ways to engage women in particularly in low-income communities with healthcare while they're pregnant, that by looking to the past and some of the initiatives that worked as well as those that did not, we might better understand a way forward. Now, prenatal care does have rather a funny history because it's kind of juxtaposed between medicine, midwifery, and nursing, and particularly public health nursing. And depending on the location, prenatal care forms part of nursing history, where any available care was provided by either the district or the public health nurse, with midwives setting their boundary of responsibility as starting only when the mother went into labor and continuing into the postnatal period. Elsewhere, doctors played a key role in shaping prenatal care, not simply in driving the push to hospital births and the medicalization of childbirth, as Anne Oakley and others have described, but also in deciding whether prenatal care became routine practice or the exception, and sometimes classifying it as unnecessary. So hence, while by the 1920s, most Western countries recognized the potential benefits of prenatal care to both mother and infant, the local and national boundaries of responsibility of provision were locally dependent, making it necessary to look beyond traditional nation-state boundaries to locate and understand the cross-cutting influences. Or to put it more simply, as Stephen Berger has argued, as an historical method, comparative histories help us to test, modify, and even falsify historical explanation. Now, I'm hoping today I'm not going to falsify anything, but I want to trace the nurse's footsteps in contributing to the development of prenatal care in America and Britain before the Second World War, and examining continuities and divergences in their roles in engaging low-income women with preventive health care. Now, America and Great Britain provide good comparators because these were the two countries that in the early 20th century, they were the ones looking to each other for obstetrical developments, for ways to tackle the high infant and maternal mortality rates. And they're also looking to each other to learn about their public health programs and what worked and what did not. Moreover, in the early 20th century, only Switzerland and Spain had higher death rates from diseases of pregnancy. Now I'm told there's, there's Switzerland and Spain at 15 and 19.6%. They're the only two countries that have higher death rates than do the US and Scotland, where they're quite similar at 14.9 and 14.8 per 1,000 live births. Now, England was faring slightly better at this time at 11.1%. So that's sort of the bit broader framework, but within those three countries, I've needed to narrow it down to cities for comparison, and I chose three. I chose for America, Philadelphia, Liverpool, England, and Glasgow, Scotland. Why these three cities? At different times over the course of the 20th century, these three port cities welcomed large numbers of immigrants. They're industrial ports, they all have pockets of extreme poverty, and they all have a core of their immigrants working in working on the docks. Due to the extreme poverty, few people in any of these cities could afford health care, and which meant that widespread prenatal care would require the involvement of government or voluntary groups. Starting with America as to why Philadelphia, of the American states, in 1910, Pennsylvania had the worst death rates from diseases of pregnancy and confinement. Of the principal cities within the United States, Philadelphia vied with Detroit, Pittsburgh, and Providence for the second highest death rates in the country after Washington, D.C., which surpassed the entire nation. In Scotland, Glasgow not only suffered some of the highest maternal and infant mortality rates in the UK, but it suffered, and it still does suffer, some of the highest poverty rates within Great Britain. And those images on the left are from the four big cities within Scotland, Aberdeen, Dundee, Edinburgh, and Glasgow, and the highest rates of poverty, which are rates that are above the national poverty levels, are the ones in red, which the picture basically says it all. In terms of poverty. And as for why Liverpool, England, it also suffered high poverty rates, and it had an economy based solely around the docks. Yet during the interwar years, Liverpool was a bit different. Liverpool city government and health officials viewed maternal mortality as a significant social problem, and they sought to tackle it, and they had some success. Between 1914 and 1948, Liverpool boasted a maternal mortality rate which was consistently below the national average. Its infant mortality rate, which was above the national average, but a maternal mortality rate which was below the average, which was unusual for a city at that time. Yet prenatal provision in the city was patchy, particularly in the low-income communities, which suggests other contributors behind the low mortality rates. So in sum, why these three cities? The commonality of high poverty levels, high immigration, and migration in the three cities, and yet they have varied maternal mortality figures. And that's part of the reason for why I'm choosing these three cities as my comparators for today and as I go ahead with my project. And my argument centers on how both the expansion and uptake of prenatal care related to the neighborhood provision of health care, the health education initiatives, many of which were led by nurses, and most importantly, the recognition of economic and social practicalities amongst the clientele. District nurses played an important role in engaging the low-income women within these services, And moreover, while there are commonalities to the prenatal nursing within across the three cities, and the essence of nursing, which also transcended regions, there are variations in initiatives and definitions of the boundaries of nursing responsibility, both within and between the communities. And those are evident with my case studies. So now to delve a bit more detail into the three, I'll start with Philadelphia, simply because it was the first of the three cities to introduce prenatal services in low-income communities. Turn to the 20th century Philly. In addition to the docks, much of its economy related to textiles and metalworks. And there were multiple employment opportunities, and those were the initiatives that attracted both men and women, immigrants from many countries, and economic migrants, including the African Americans. The city grew rapidly, and the population growth put strains on the city's infrastructure, so that by 1908, the city's Bureau of Health argued a need for both educating the population about sanitation and health and the important role that a nurse could play in health education. Indeed, they started looking at the housing, looking at how tenants can be educated, and there's much room for the work of educating tenants, instructing them concerning the dangers to their own health. And indeed, who would be responsible? Not only the Division of Sanitary Inspection, but of visiting nurses, if they were created. So the emphasis is on health education and the important role of the nurse within this. But I also found this quote interesting because it says the visiting nurses, if they were created. Because there's been a visiting nurse association in Philadelphia since 1886. It's the Visiting Nurse Society of Philadelphia. This was a voluntary organization designed to provide nursing care to the sick poor in the homes along the lines of the British Queen's nurses. Indeed, in the late 19th century, the only other cities in America that had district nurses were Buffalo and Boston. The Philadelphia Visiting Nurse Society was run by middle-class women, and it was funded by churches, relief organizations, and individuals, and hence not initially controlled by municipal regulations. Nevertheless, the society had high standards for the nurses. They required them to be highly trained. Most were educated at one of the city's nurse training schools. Yet despite the remit, which was to care for all illnesses and look after the sick poor in the homes, by the early 20th century, more than half the Philadelphia district nursing cases involved maternity and child health. The nurses aided physicians and the registered midwives with home deliveries, and they made follow-up visits to help the mothers bathe and feed their newborns and to instruct them in infant welfare. And from 1915, they also provided coordinated care and instruction for expectant mothers. Now, the nurses did not discriminate amongst the patients, and they spent considerable time in the mainly immigrant and colored neighborhoods. And the nurses recognized, too, that because prenatal checks were new, expectant mothers needed to be made aware not just of the perceived need for health checks, but also where they could go to get health care. And so for this reason, the nurses walked through the immigrant communities, literally knocking on doors and seeking out pregnant women. They introduced themselves and the Visiting Nurse Society, and they explained the signs and symptoms of pregnancy and why nursing care could be helpful during pregnancy. And a few of the nurses came from an immigrant background. And so that was helpful. They could use their common nationality, national identity, and occasionally their language to try and engage with some of the women in the immigrant communities and start to build trust between themselves as a nurse and the community. It also may well, though, have been an attempt to try and ensure that the immigrant women used trained nurses and midwives rather than relying on immigrant midwives, who were perceived, and little is known about the immigrant midwives, so I have to say they were perceived to have little or no training. At the same time, too, by getting ingrained in the immigrant communities, it could also help with the Americanization process of new immigrants. Nevertheless, these Philadelphia nurses were some of the first providers of community prenatal care in America, visiting expectant mothers in their homes with health education, not the physical health checks, the early focus of the visits. what actually comprised this prenatal education? Well, in many ways, it followed the Board of Health's emphasis on sanitation, in that it comprised sanitation and trying to improve diet. They advised pregnant women about habits of cleanliness and hygiene. But it also included trying to persuade the mother to look after herself as she prepared for her new baby, and trying to persuade her that by guarding her own health, she guards that of the baby as well. And you can see in the picture there the uniforms they used to wear. So they were recognized as they went to communities. Everybody would know that she was the nurse in the community. So they're sort of building their presence and the recognition of who they were within the communities, so that over time they would hope to become a person who could be trusted. Now, these nurses also sought to make sure that the mother got enough to eat and knew what comprised a good diet. The nurses also provided information about where the expectant mothers could obtain additional medical advice, usually at a hospital, or in some neighborhoods there was a hospital dispensary. For example, some of the nurses cooperated with the city's Women's Medical College, which had opened an outpatient maternity clinic in 1888 under the wonderful doctor Anna Brumall. Now, Brumall was not only one of America's first women doctors, she was one of the leading obstetricians, and she had reputedly never refused a case because it might not mean any money. And she also was a firm believer in prenatal care, and she opened a clinic at the hospital dispensary, which she claimed was the first such clinic in America. I'm still unable to confirm that, but either way, it was one of the first prenatal clinics in America. And common to both the hospital clinic and the visiting nurses was the fact that they focused their prenatal provision and instruction in low-income communities. That's where they tried to establish themselves. And both the doctor and the nurses tried to improve the health of the mother and infant. Yet this is well before the federal government officially recognized the relationship between household income and infant mortality. Yet these people were working in the low-income communities in the late 19th century. The Visiting Nurse Society expanded rapidly. By 1920, the nurses were also attending deliveries in most parts of the city, providing a woman with continuity of care throughout pregnancy, birth, and the postnatal period, although they rarely delivered the baby. Whereas previously, the nurses had been unable to offer care at birth due to the shortage of nurses. So there was sort of a gap in the continuity that provided the prenatal care and the postnatal care, and someone else would come in and deliver the baby. But because of the increase of nurses, they could not only expand the services they provided, but that increase in nurse numbers suggests widespread recognition for the work, because they were dependent on donations for not only operating, but also staff expenses. However, service expansion also led to recognition for greater efficiency. After all, regular visits to women in the home was very time-consuming and labor-intensive. So by 1922, the Visiting Nurse Society had opened a few community health centers, which provided various health care services, including prenatal care. However, the VNS found that clinic attendance varied greatly, depending on both the distance from a woman's home and also the weather, which led them to decide, right, they would do a combination of clinic-based care and home visits, and they operated in parallel through the mid-20th century. Now, the Visiting Nurse Society efforts did not go unnoticed by Philadelphia's Municipal Bureau of Health. However, the chief of the bureau, Dr. A.C. Abbott, wanted the nurses under the supervision of the city. In other words, he wanted a formal system of community nursing controlled by the city. He also recognized that while hospitals played a very important role in maternity care, so did the nurses and the midwives, particularly in the immigrant communities, where midwives from the home countries were preferred, but he recognized that the VNS might be able to help persuade the immigrant women to use trained American nurses or American-born nurses. Instead, he also saw a clear division of services between the nurses and some of the hospital clinics and dispensaries, which provided health advice and care as well. So he recognized the visiting nurses as being particularly important in the immigrant communities, whereas the hospitals and were where care should develop overall for all women within the city. However, nevertheless, it was helpful for the VNS to have Bureau of Health recognition of their provision, because their success in engaging women with prenatal care stemmed from their combination of providing care in the women's home and in the community, and in providing health education with the patient at the center. And I would argue that from all the records reading through them, that seems to be their emphasis. Historians argue that Americanization was at the core of some of the district nursing efforts, but I would say that's more of an added bonus than a driver of their services, particularly in terms of maternity care. However, they're not the only ones in the market in Philadelphia, and indeed not the only nurses who are trying to raise awareness about maternal and infant health. There are municipal and other broader efforts at educating mothers around this time. In 1912, the City Bureau of Health ran a very popular baby week and a baby show with the aim of trying to teach the general public about infant health and well-being. The following year, in 1913, the Federal Children's Bureau published a booklet on prenatal care, which quickly became popular amongst the middle-class women. But it also encouraged greater provision throughout the cities. Indeed, shortly after this was published, Philadelphia's prenatal care, or the people providing it, expanded rapidly in the city's poorest neighborhoods. In addition to the Visiting Nurse Society, by 1914, you have the Star Center providing prenatal care. And they opened their first prenatal care during World War I. Now, the Star Center had been established by Theodore Starr in 1878, to provide first cooperative and later charitable community services, including some nursing services. But it was the First World War when they started to visit expectant mothers at frequent intervals. So that by 1920, they were averaging 15 to 16 prenatal visits per mother. Moreover, like the VNS, the Star Center nurses also went into the community and were seeking out pregnant women and explaining the benefits of health checks to both the woman and her infant. And again, their emphasis is on health education. Now, the city was also trying to establish municipal nurse provision, which did broad community nursing, but also pre- and postnatal care. And they expected their nurses to visit each expectant mother on average every 10 days throughout her pregnancy. So clearly, all the different providers of prenatal care, all the nurses are expected to do very regular visits to the women. So that while by the 1920s, the city of Philadelphia and the voluntary sector were recognizing not only just how important health care was for expectant mothers and their infants, but they're also recognizing how public health interventions, of all the public health interventions that they were doing, perhaps this was the most effective and had the greatest chance at improving health outcomes. They also recognized, too, though, just how important locally available health care was and home visits. They were what were attracting the women and getting them to engage with service provision. However, as well, by the 1920s, the actual prenatal care delivered was also changing. During the 1920s, in the wake of the Federal Shepherd-Towner Bill of 1921, which sought to address maternal and infant mortality, the content of their visits were becoming increasingly scientific. They're combining the latest science about maternity, and including physical health checks and education. By the 1920s, at each visit, Star Center nurses now also took a blood pressure reading, and they would secure a specimen of urine for examination, in addition to also advising the mother about proper care for herself and the baby regards to hygiene. So the content of prenatal visits was also changing rapidly. So too, it wasn't just the Star Center, the Visiting Nurse Society and municipal nurses were similarly adapting their provision to include the latest science. Yet common to all these nurses was the firm belief that all women would look after theirs and their baby's health if they knew how to, and that's why they emphasized so much the health education. Nevertheless, during the 1920s, prenatal provision was increasingly trying to combine home visits with clinics. Again, the quest for efficiency, but also as knowledge about prenatal care and its importance became more widely known. There was a hope that more women would come to the clinic as it became more widely known. And that's the Visiting Nurse Society Clinic in 1932, and they did have a couple others operating around the city. And the hope was that the low-income women in Philadelphia would be increasingly accepting of the message of the importance of healthcare checks while they were pregnant. Yet, they found that women still balanced healthcare with other factors, including family needs, work, and the weather. And so they could not simply rely on the clinics for provision of prenatal care. They needed to still have these nurses out in the community doing home visits and trying to engage the women with the importance of health care. So that by the 1930s, you certainly have some aspects of prenatal care in Philadelphia well established and with a wide array of municipal, voluntary, and hospital provision. Nevertheless, in the 1930s again, the Star Center introduced almost a house-to-house canvas throughout the neighborhoods where they worked to again explain prenatal care, because you have new immigrants coming, and so again, new groups that needed to be educated about the benefits of the care and the services they offered. By this time too, though, the combined efforts of the charities, the hospitals, science, and the city, they had started to make some inroads into lowering the city's maternal and infant mortality rates. Yet medical understandings surrounding just how many prenatal visits were also changing. By 1941, visits were recommended every 2 weeks until the 8th month, when weekly visits were considered important. So almost a growing number of visits. The Bureau of Health remained concerned that some women still did not present until the 5th or 6th months of pregnancy. So while they're making inroads in some neighborhoods, elsewhere, they are not. And again, they're starting to renew education campaigns once more. So despite the widespread educational efforts of municipal, hospital, and voluntary services in the first half of the 20th century, in 1949, the city of Philadelphia still bemoaned the lack of adequate prenatal care for expectant mothers and of lying-in accommodation for free cases. So while the district nurses had been instrumental in developing the prenatal habit in some low-income communities in the city, the poorest constituents and the newest immigrants still struggled to access care by mid-century, while local communities struggled to meet the health needs of their constituents. So indeed, during the first half of the 20th century, Philadelphia's prenatal provision never became a comprehensive service that reached all mothers. However, the efforts of the city governments, the charities, the hospitals, and the dispensaries, they did go some way towards engaging new immigrants and low-income women with pregnancy care and the benefits of it. Moreover, the politicians and doctors increasingly recognized the important role that these community nurses played in reaching some of the city's most marginal citizens. The nurses were a visible, available, local presence and were the driving force behind developing prenatal care and preventive health provision within the city. Now, before I conclude about Philadelphia, I want to turn to Britain, and then I'll try and draw all the strands together. Early 20th century Britain, what's happening? Local and national governments, social reformers, medical professionals, they're all targeting maternity care for reform in a specific attempt to try and reduce the prevailing high rate of infant mortality. That's the focus rather than initial focus before maternal mortality. World War I only highlighted the need for reforms. In 1915, throughout Britain, there were only 12 antenatal clinics. Now, in 1918, the British government passed the Maternity and Child Welfare Act, which required local authorities to appoint maternity and child welfare committees. But it did not compel them to introduce comprehensive maternity services. And so antenatal clinics expanded, but fairly slowly. In 1918, there were 120. By 1933, there were just over 1,400 throughout Britain. But in Liverpool, in 1916, there was one, based in the Voluntary Liverpool Maternity Hospital. However, in the city's political, medical, and social circles, debates rage about the causes of maternal mortality. Was it were mothers dying because of social and economic deprivation, or the poor standards of maternity care? Certainly, Liverpool's economy centered around the docks, with few opportunities in the underdeveloped manufacturers, which in other towns attracted women workers, which meant that when women got married, they pretty much did not work. They left the labor market, and they were dependent on the low wages that their husbands who worked in the docks made. And while little is known about the women's casual and informal paid work, they were largely dependent on their husbands, not simply for money, but also for national insurance. Introduced in 1911, national insurance health benefits included some maternity benefit. But until 1913, these were paid to the husband, not the wife. And he didn't always come home with the money. Pass on to the pub with his friends. Moreover, many people in the city, and particularly in politics, so the middle classes, they believe poverty was the fault of individuals, not economic and social factors. Therefore, if you're going to offer charity, including charitable health care, it had to only be for the deserving few. Indeed, public health initiatives, which had grown rapidly over the last half century, they'd focused on sanitary initiatives and vaccination, not individual health care services, because of the central role of morality in charity. You had to be the deserving poor to get charitable health care. Indeed, it was 1922 before Liverpool's medical officer of health, who was responsible for the public health in the city, who recognized that maternal mortality was actually a problem that needed to be addressed. During the 1920s, the cure was antenatal care. That was seen as a cure for the town's high maternal mortality rates, although when, during the 1930s, maternal mortality rates were found to have changed little, they reevaluated this perception. Nevertheless, as I mentioned earlier, between 1914 and 1948, Liverpool boasted a maternal mortality rate which was consistently below the national average. And if you think of Lancashire County, which is where it's based, it had the lowest within the whole county. Yet the city's infant mortality rates remained above the national average. So this means that if any of you are into more morbid history, if Irvin Loudon's analysis of maternal mortality is correct, then the high poverty rates in Liverpool, alongside its low maternal mortality rates, it suggests that the standard of local maternity services was perhaps a more decisive factor in determining maternal mortality than socioeconomic factors. But if the only clinic was at the Liverpool Maternity Office Hospital, what else other prenatal care was available? Well, between World War I and the introduction of a national health service in 1948, the choice of maternity service was expanding slowly in the city, providing a marginal consumer's market. But in low-income neighborhoods, choices were much more limited. These did include the district nurses and the well-known Liverpool Queen Victoria Jubilee nurses. You have the Brownlow Hill Poor Law Institution and maternity homes, but the maternity homes, if the applicant's moral character was a much more important factor for accessing care through the 1920s than actual need. And you also had a few religious charities and independent midwives, although it's unclear just how many of the midwives actually provided prenatal care and how many instead simply referred women to hospital clinics. Indeed, by 1927, the Liverpool Social Workers Yearbook found that the hospital clinics and midwives had established a good collaborative network, which only aided the clinic's success. And the positive relationship between the hospital clinics and midwives was even recognized by the state's Ministry of Health, the Public Health Service. Yet both the Public Health Service and Histories of Liverpool marginalized the work of district nurses in maternity care, and indeed most institutions other than the Liverpool Maternity Hospital. For example, during the 1920s, the Brownlow Hill Poor Law Institution, which began its existence as a workhouse for the destitute, it was becoming a destination of choice for maternity care amongst respectable working class women because of its reputation for good health care. In other communities, district nurses visited pregnant women in their homes, similar in many ways to the Philadelphia district nurses. For example, in 1919, the Woolton District Nurse Society provided domiciliary nursing services and prenatal care, and they visited pregnant women in their home. Now, Woolton was a village that had been incorporated into Liverpool in 1913. That same year, the society argued the need for an antenatal clinic to try and increase women's education about the importance of pregnancy care to both the mother and the infant health. And remember, this is at a time when the medical officer of health emphasized infant welfare to the neglect of the mothers. Yet when the Woolton district nurses could not find a suitable location for the antenatal clinic, they instead decided that they would continue home visits of antenatal care. In contrast, the Liverpool Queen Victoria District Nurse Association provided little maternity care. Instead, they emphasized domiciliary nursing services because of staffing and because by 1931 they thought that the maternity cases were going to the hospitals and nursing homes. Indeed, prior to the National Health Service in Liverpool, most antenatal care was provided by the hospitals, and this was supported by many of the nurses and midwives due mostly to the lack of funds to expand their provision in the community. The Woolton district nurses were perhaps the exception. However, by the 1930s, the voluntary hospitals were experiencing a financial crisis because the demand on them superseded their income. And that left women, or mothers, with very long waits at the clinic. And many of the women could not or would not wait, and either stopped engaging with the provision, or they turned to general practitioners or the charity and voluntary sector for care. Here, both consumer choice and social and economic practicalities were driving the women's choices. For example, in the Catholic community which surrounded the Brownlow Poor Law Institution, they turned to the nuns. There were the Sisters of Mercy, but most notably the Catholic Sisters of Bon Secours, which translates as the Sisters of Good Help to those in need. And they provided community antenatal and maternity care in a way that seems somewhat similar to that on the show called The Midwife. Now, I'm still trying to access the records and learn more about the services they provided, but other references to them suggest that they were a popular source of pregnancy health care and advice in the community they served. Now, this may well have been due to a religious affiliation with the people in the neighborhood, because it certainly was a heavily Catholic neighborhood. That bit's unclear. However, some community nurses, the sisters and a few others, they seem to have recognized that preventive care would benefit both the expectant mother and her child, and that communities was a place where it should be based. In other communities, though, the lack of funds meant that nurses had to refer women to hospital clinics or general practice doctors. And that meant that attendance at clinics was very disparate throughout the cities. And I'm still trying to sort of map where they went to the clinics and where the community nurses were working. But preliminary geographic mapping seems to be that where the community nurses were working was where attendance was greater. But not quite there yet to say that for definite. And certainly in many areas of the city, the lack of funds meant nurses had to refer women to the clinics or the general practice doctors, and the disparate provision only hindered the development of consistent antenatal care and hindering the development of prenatal checks as a habit amongst women. However, something also needs to be said about women's decision-making concerning uptake of care in Liverpool. In areas of deprivation, childbearing women were much more likely to place a higher premium on the non-clinical aspects of maternity, such as the cost of care, the location, the availability of childcare, and help in the home at around the time of birth. So while attendance at the city antenatal clinics very gradually increased over the years, both proportion and clientele are unclear. However, we do know that Liverpool's long history of poor social and economic conditions undermined independent midwifery because most women could not afford to pay the midwife a reasonable fee and were dependent on voluntary and poor law hospitals. Hence, in Liverpool, I would suggest that money, distance, and to an extent, ignorance about the need for maternity care were large influence on women's choices of maternity care, with many women still avoiding antenatal altogether because of cost, distance, or lack of knowledge, and instead, selecting the cheapest option. And these factors, combined with the limited community provision and reliance on hospitals, only further contributed to the difficulties in coordinating prenatal care in much of the city and making it a habit throughout the city rather than only small pockets of it. Now, to just turn very briefly to Glasgow, and then I'll draw all these three different stories together. Early 20th century Glasgow, Scotland. The economy is based on heavy industry, similar to Liverpool, but in Glasgow it was coal, steel, and shipbuilding, with small manufacturers like Singer sewing machines and a few textile companies providing some employment for women. But most workers lived in overcrowded tenements, with 12 or more living in one room, and everybody knew their neighbor's business. Now, while the growing British interest in the health of a nation in the early 20th century, and particularly that of mothers, did secure improvements in maternal and child health in England and Wales, these were not shared by Scotland. And this was despite the gradual increase in legislative efforts in Scotland, where legislation is quite often different from that in England and Wales. But in Scotland, since 1903, legislation had sought to address the high infant and child mortality rates, particularly the introduction in 1915 of the Midwives Scotland Act, which was aimed at both improving and standardizing midwifery training. Yet this and later legislation were very slow to have an effect, partly because the shift to utilizing state-sponsored provision involved changing people's outlook, as well as a change in providers. Many Scots found the shift to increasing state control in their everyday lives very difficult to accept, something to be suspicious of, and something to be avoided. Politically, there remained an uncompromising attitude towards claimant of welfare and state-sponsored health provision, so there was a heavy reliance on charities. There was also a conservative attitude towards relief that pervaded much of Scottish society, including amongst those who would most likely be the beneficiaries. So if you're going to introduce new health services, and particularly preventive measures, it was almost destined to struggle from the start. In Glasgow, this was particularly evident because they lacked any kind of coordinated maternity service. Indeed, when in 1937, the Maternity Service Scotland Act was introduced, which required local authorities to coordinate and control maternity services and to introduce a spirit of team working, the city government rejected it and decided they weren't going to follow it. Instead, during the first half of the 20th century, Glasgow's maternity care fell under the remit of public health doctors, and they saw antenatal clinics as the efficient way to provide health care. Shortly after World War I, the city medical officer of health, Dr. Archibald Chalmers, opened several antenatal clinics in low-income communities throughout the city. However, these soon closed due to lack of attendance. And indeed, you can see just the distinct contrast here between Glasgow and what's happening in England, where by 1945, roughly 70% of women were attending prenatal clinics, whereas in 1946 in Glasgow, you're barely at 50%. Upon seeing the failures of the municipal clinics, midwifery provision of prenatal care took a different route. After the 1915 Midwives Scotland Act, the Scottish Central Midwives Board, or CMB, revised its rules so that their midwives should advise each pregnant woman to avail herself of the local authority antenatal and child welfare clinics. Yet by 1926, the midwives were trying to increase their role in antenatal provision, possibly because they realized that the local authority clinics were not doing much to engage with the women, as in not providing much health education and staffing many of their clinics often with male student doctors. The chair of the CMB was gynecologist Dr. James Haig Ferguson. He stressed that the midwives should be trained in antenatal care and have indeed examined and received instruction in the supervision of not less than 20 pregnant women, including bookkeeping and the keeping of records. And he saw antenatal clinics as affording excellent opportunities for instruction in the hygiene of pregnancy and in abdominal palpation and in the care and treatment of the minor disturbances of pregnancy. The problem was a lot of the clinics were run by the doctors, and so you have the tensions of would they allow the midwives in for training, or did that have to take place in a different setting? Nevertheless, throughout the 1920s and 30s, the CMB worked to improve midwifery training in antenatal care, and they emphasized the central role of that midwives could play in delivering the care and securing uptake. Now, while they experienced successes in Edinburgh, the capital, Glasgow has frequently followed a different medical path from Edinburgh, which was reflected in the city's rejection of the 1930s regulations. The Glasgow midwives did not provide the antenatal care recommended by the RCM guidelines, which were based in Edinburgh, despite the fact that midwives attended the majority of the city's births into the 1960s. And this raises two questions. Why didn't Glasgow's midwives promote antenatal care, particularly in low-income communities, and why were many women reluctant to avail themselves of the prenatal clinics? And I would say that the answer to both are closely related. Firstly, in Glasgow, you have a class divide which rejected state-sponsored health provision, and you have an overwhelming conservative attitude towards relief, whereby almost everybody, no matter what their income, considered government welfare should be a very last resort. Consequently, many local authorities' public health initiatives and clinics were viewed with suspicion. What was the motivation? What would happen? Moreover, unlike in Edinburgh, few early 20th century Glasgow doctors were interested in obstetrics. In fact, in 1923, the Glasgow obstetrician, John Martin Munro Kerr, argued that mothers were to blame for their ill health, from ignorance, apathy, ill health, or prejudice. Social reformers, politicians, and other doctors have also blamed working class mothers, declaring them to be unfit, whether for their poor nutrition, their lack of knowledge, or their general maternal inadequacies. Now, there may well be some truth in these claims. Antenatal care did not really exist until the early 20th century, so you had to educate women about not only the availability of care, but also its importance for both the mother and the baby's health. In addition, in the first half of the 20th century, biological understanding was virtually non-existent, particularly amongst the general population, in Scotland. So to an extent, care was right. Women were ignorant about their bodies and the need for pregnancy care. Many women did not even realize they were pregnant until they went into labor. Both the cities and doctors provided little health education about the female body or pregnancy, and any information available would have been unlikely to reach society's poorest. Add to that how Scotland was a country where religion had, and still has, a strong moral influence over society. Sex and pregnancy simply were not talked about socially, between women, or between mother and daughter. And this is a quote from a collection of oral histories of midwives. The silence about sex, pregnancy, everything related to that, it may well have contributed to why women did not attend prenatal clinics. Indeed, oral histories from midwives and district nurses working during the 1920s through the 1960s recalled only learning a woman was pregnant when called to a birth. about being chased by a little boy saying, "Me ma'am needs you." For women who knew they were pregnant, midwives were booked for delivery, but not for prenatal care, cost being a primary consideration. Instead, women were expected to avail themselves of the free antenatal clinics, either municipal or at the maternity homes. Yet, as I mentioned before, these were run by medical students, not midwives, and they were not in the local neighborhood. And if they were a long way away and you already have existing children, would you be dragging them across the city to go to the clinics? And even if you didn't have babies, would you be going up and down the hills to a clinic a long ways away? For many women, that was just considered unrealistic. Yet having clinics run by medical students, not midwives, left midwives and district nurses kind of caught in the middle. They don't run the clinics. There were frequently unaware pregnancies until called to birth, yet the professional body, the CMB, expected them to offer women antenatal care and advice. Now, while my paper ends at World War II, I would suggest the Glasgow midwives and district nurses' role in antenatal did gradually increase during mid-century as they developed their community networks of trust. I've argued elsewhere that district nurses were instrumental in providing public health education, but only after they'd been invited into a home and established a relationship with the family. And the same would hold true for prenatal care. After delivering a first baby and making postnatal visits, the nurse midwife would have a relationship with the mother and her family and could offer health advice for future pregnancies. In Glasgow, the widespread knowledge about and the provision of antenatal care was constrained by political priorities and prejudices, medical disinterest, poverty, and social mores. Working within such confines, both district nurses and midwives had little scope to expand their services. Instead, widespread poverty meant they provided the care and advice only when requested. Nurses' oral histories reveal how women knew when they needed help, whether for a complicated pregnancy or when in labor. And they also knew when to call either the district nurse or the midwife, whoever was nearby. They were recognized for their uniform, but also because they were known in the community. Hence, while women may well have been ignorant about some aspects about their body and about pregnancy, they knew when something was wrong, and it was usually the nurses and midwives who were their first point of call for help. So now to conclude by drawing these three narratives together, hopefully. Firstly, they reveal how the introduction and spread of prenatal care was dependent on so much more than merely providers and provision. The socioeconomic, political, medical, and even moral context all helped to shape the development, provision, and women's uptake of antenatal care in the three cities. Now, the Philadelphia nurses certainly seem to have had the greatest agency of the nurses. They were the first in their city to recognize a healthcare need, and which originated outside municipal provision. But also because contested boundaries about pregnancy care were not yet evident in the city. Lastly, the nurses in Philadelphia recognized the importance of a local community-based healthcare if they were to engage with low-income women unfamiliar with the healthcare services. In contrast, in Liverpool, the lack of money for community services and the strength of medical and political priorities centered prenatal care in the hospitals. Yet there was remained charitable provision in some low-income communities, creating a patched network of care and inconsistent care across the cities. Lastly, in Glasgow, during the first half of the 20th century, poverty, social, and political prejudice prevented the development and the uptake of widespread antenatal care. Instead, community nurses and midwives provided the care the pregnant woman requested at their time of need. Common to all three cities, nurses provided care for pregnant women within the constraints they faced. In all cities, but particularly Philadelphia and Glasgow, it was the nurses' relationships with the women that secured the trust of the clientele, and this only developed over time. Certainly Philadelphia nurses achieved this earlier. Yet the paradox of preventive health care remains. The ability to shift behaviors was and remains problematic and contested. Yet in all communities, these nurses reached some pregnant women in a way that hospitals did not. They engaged with women on a practical level while also recognizing the lived constraints of poverty. Together, these three stories illustrate how difficult it can be to develop high-quality, coordinated care when socioeconomic, political, and moral factors inhibit both the development of services and patient uptake. Thank you very much. I don't know if there's time for questions or, sorry?
I just want to get a picture before you. I think you get a good one there. Sorry. I don't want the mic right in
your face. The mic is in a bit of all the place.
Yeah, that's good.
Good work. Okay.
I think we have time
Thank
for
you.
Questions.
Yeah, yeah, please.
Do you have any questions?
I welcome any feedback.
I'm going to give them a few minutes. Oh, yeah. Some.
Yes.
In your three cities, any of the groups of visiting nurses or midwives, did they live within the communities?
Some did, some didn't. In Liverpool, they certainly seem to have lived in the communities. In Philadelphia, there was a central nurses' home within the community where some nurses lived, but others lived elsewhere. So they tried to have the nurses living in the communities, but not always. In Glasgow, again, in parts that they would have a nurse's home, but then they would either walk or jump on their bicycles and go to other parts of the city. So this lived within the area, but not directly in the necessarily in the communities they served. So I hope that's not too vague. Someone else had a question. Yes.
Yes, thank you for a very interesting comparison. I was just wondering if you could already, based on your findings, say whether there were then also particular differences between these three cities in terms of outcome or reducing numbers, depending on how, or whether it was depending on how the nurses had, care had been organized.
I'm still trying to patch together the hospital provision, because, well, I'll take each city in turn. In Philadelphia, certainly the Bureau of Health recognized just how important the nurses were in engaging women in prenatal care, and they were very actively involved. But Philadelphia also had lots of hospitals springing up and maternity hospitals who wanted to attract the women there to have their babies. And they started to open antenatal clinics in 1920s, some in the 1930s. But the problem was getting the women to go to the hospital. And so I'm trying to match up the their initiatives. They seem to do less of the health education initiatives, but rather simply provide the service and hope to capture women, particularly for the second, third, and later babies. So you're sort of working in tandem, and I'm trying to currently work out the balance between them. But the Visiting Nurse Society and the STAR centers, they were going well after mid-century into the 1960s, and they were still playing an important role, less so in visiting women in their homes, but more so in the clinics. In Liverpool, Liverpool seems to be a bit of an anomaly because of the shortage of nurses. Even the nurses seem to be trying to send the women to the hospitals. It's when they realize that the women aren't going to go to the hospitals or can't go to the hospitals, or for whatever reason they're not going, that some in some communities started to provide antenatal provision. But because of money and the power of the doctors in trying to centralize maternity care at the hospitals, that seems to be where the clinics were developing. And I mentioned the Sisters of Bon Secours. I'm still trying to access their records, but I don't know if you've heard of the mother and baby home scandal in Ireland. They were involved in that, and they don't particularly like historians asking about any of their records. But I'm not giving up yet. So you'll see. I might be able to find out what they have. I might not. And just how much they were doing in the community. In Liverpool, certainly the Rotten Row, as it was called, the Glasgow Maternity Hospital, had an antenatal clinic. But part of the reason, I think, that women still had their babies in the home into the 1960s is because poor women was looked down upon so much in the hospital. When they were arrived, Lindsay Reed has looked into this, when the women arrived in the hospital, they were stripped of all their clothes, put on the slab, which was literally a marble slab, and hosed down. And many babies were actually born there. No matter what state of labor you were in, you didn't get any further until you were hosed down on the slab. And you might imagine that when this information gets out in the community, it might contribute to women's reluctance to go to the hospital. Not to mention, the Rotten Row is on a hill that's like that. So if you had to go there for an antenatal clinic and try and climb up the hill when you are pregnant, which I actually tried to do when I was 7 months pregnant, it is a very long, slow slog. So you can see why women were deterred from using the hospitals, and while they referred to the nurses in the community, and cost, they knew who to turn to when they needed help, but they also didn't have the money to pay for regular health care. And there's the attitude that, you know, if mom didn't have any, why should I have any? It takes a long time to change attitudes, particularly in Glasgow.
Yeah, my question actually is related to that. Particularly for groups like the STAR organization in Philadelphia or anywhere, was there any attempt by these people who were working in these communities to change that prejudice? And I'm thinking particularly of the impact of the Depression, because I've looked at a child welfare association in my hometown, St. John's, and one of the things they did in the 30s was to provide clean milk depots and clothing, and to actually try to expand their services to meet material needs of their clientele. And, you know, some of their students, you still do see that prejudice for sure. This is run really by upper class women. But there are also statements about, you know, we could say all this, but if they, you know, if they don't have enough money for decent food, what can they do?
Thank you for asking that question. I had to cut that paragraph out. Yes, they were developing. They telegraphically. But no, in the 1920s and 30s, particularly the STAR Center did start providing clothing and milk depots, and the Visiting Nurse Society did too. They didn't always have. The STAR Center did more things in central organizations, whereas the Visiting Nurse Society was more willing to go door to door and not deliver milk, but sometimes bring food with them as well. The Visiting Nurse Society seemed to recognize more of the cultural differences and how some cultures would be the shame of having to take charity. But both did try and provide practical assistance as well as healthcare, because as I said, you know, they recognize that to be a healthy mother, you need to have a sufficient diet.
I think we're
okay.
Gloria's calling it out.
Catch me later.
Yeah, there you go. We just want to thank you. Thank you for that lecture. Great lectures.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And we just have a small present.
Well, thank you. That's so kind of you. Thank you very much.
We're going to invite you in a short break, a shorter break. And I think we started in 10:45, right, Gloria? 10:45 back here. Thanks.
Thank you.
Oh,
that was really nice.
Yes.
Thank you for the kind introduction.
Oh, Gloria's picking me up. There. Yeah. Things I have to do, which is like, oh, you're giving me time. But yeah, that was really great.
Oh, well, thank you.
I like the reference with the.